This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast, and in this week's episode, we'll be looking at Italy's new coalition. What will the five-star and Lega partnership mean for Italy and for Europe? We'll also talk about whether conservatives have been hard enough on Israel for its violent put-down of the Gaza protests. And on a slightly different note, we'll be asking, why are powerful men so fond of being spanked? First up, Italy is forming a government. In the March elections, no single party received more than 40% of the vote, leaving the most successful party, the Five Star Movement, forming a strange coalition with the party Lega. The two are not natural allies, with Five Star drawing most of its support from the left, and Lega, a member of the coalition of the right. But, as Nicholas Farrell writes in this week's cover story, stranger things have happened, and Frederick Erickson writes that Macron is already preparing to change tack to deal with the new coalition. Frederick, who is the director of the European Centre for International Political Economy, joins us now, together with Ferdinando Giuliani, Bloomberg and Repubblica journalist in Rome. So, Ferdinando, can you start by explaining to us what's brought these two populist parties from the extreme ends of the political spectrum together?
Well, I think the two parties are indeed very different if in terms of, for example, where they get most of their votes from. The Lega Nord gets most of its votes from the north and the Five Star Movement from the south. But actually, there is a fair amount of overlap in terms of, for example, their economic policies. I mean, both of them have toyed, for example, with the idea that Italy should leave the Eurozone. And, you know, this is something which they're currently discussing. I mean, the Five Star Movement has gone a lot colder than the Lega on this particular issue. But for sure, both parties agree that, for example, Italy should be allowed to increase its budget deficit. There should be, for example, tax cuts and higher spending. And this is obviously in contrast with what the single currency budgetary rules require. So a more confrontational attitude vis-a-vis Brussels is certainly something which both parties have at least to some extent considered in the past. So yes, they are different, but actually there are quite a lot of similarities there.
One of the things that Five Star wants to do is abolish Parliament and instead focus on sort of direct democracy. Do you think they're going to try and undermine the government from within?
Well, I think the Five Star Movement appeal to direct democracy has in a way changed over time. Initially, they would do everything online streaming for the benefit of their supporters. However, all of these negotiations with the Lega have happened behind closed doors. Yes, there are all these online consultations going on whenever the Five Star Movement takes a decision. And in fact, we know that if there were to be a coalition agreement between these two forces, the Five Star Movement will have an online consultation. But there are lots of questions over how these votes are run. The platform which the Five Star Movement uses, Russo, is owned by a private company. And this private company is very untransparent and murky in its operations. So the direct democracy appeal of the Five Star Movement, according to some analysts, is only really a propaganda tool.
And Frederick, what do you think this means for the EU project?
For the EU project itself, I think a new coalition between two populist parties in Italy will lead to a lot more friction in virtually every key debate about Europe's future and about policies that Europe is going to decide about either now or in the next couple of years. If we look, for instance, at trade policy, what we know is that neither the Five Star nor Lega are happy about free trade, and they are most likely going to veto a couple of key trade deals like the one with Japan, which is going to come to the table of the member states in the near future. They want to roll back the sanctions against Russia and ease generally the conditions for collaboration between the EU and Russia. And of course, that's not something which is appreciated by lots of other countries in Europe. And perhaps even more importantly is that both Five Star and Lega Nord wants to put a bomb under EU migration policy. They don't like at all this idea about having a mechanism at the EU level allocating refugees in Italian camps or in Greek camps to the rest of the EU. They just don't believe in that. They want to close the border. They want to deport a lot of the refugees that have come to Europe. And that's something which clash pretty profoundly with, for instance, Angela Merkel and her idea about Europe being open to refugees and providing shelter for the refugees. So a lot more friction and a lot more clashes between key governments on all these important issues.
And Frederick, in your piece, you suggest that the political situation in Italy is likely to force Emmanuel Macron to change his position. How so exactly?
I think my first point is that Macron actually don't have to change that much, because in this era of new politics where we find ourselves right now, Macron is actually pretty happy. He is in a pretty comfortable spot. And that is partly because Macron is a very odd political creature. But you are going to find many similarities between him and the populist or those that have been seeking to destroy centrist politics, either in Europe or in America. Macron is on good terms with Donald Trump. He has a respectful relation to Viktor Orban. He, I think, has some degree of understanding for those that are revolting against establishment parties or the old guard in politics, simply because that's what he has done himself. For Macron, there is, of course, a grand project that he had, which now has been scuppered because not just the election or in Italy, and because we're going to have populist parties in Rome taking power there. He wanted to see a very, very strong reform of the entire Eurozone. Just after he was elected, roughly a year ago, he launched this program about big reforms, which drew on a lot of thinking, a lot of studies, a lot of reports we've been seeing coming from the European Commission, the European Central Bank in the past. But ever since then, you see that he's gradually been winding down the substance of these ideas. He has toned down and has become a lot more pragmatic in his approach to Germany and other countries that, at least on the surface, hasn't been very supportive of these grand reforms. So over time, over the last year, he's been becoming much more pragmatic, and I would argue more recently, you can see him sort of speaking in a much less visionary and passionate tone about these reforms.
And Ferdinand, in his piece, Nicholas Farrell says that what's going on in Italy is pretty strange, even by Italian standards. How are Italians responding to this? Are they worried about what's going on, or are they excited?
Well, I think there are some people who are actually regretting voting for the Five Star Movement, partly because the Five Star Movement has been very good at catching support from both left and right by really having a very vague policy platform which appealed on both sides. Now, by teaming up with the Northern League, a right-wing party, a very right-wing party, well, they've really lost, you know, they're really confused and shocked some of their left-wing supporters. So I would say that, you know, within the base of the Five Star Movement, there is some soul-searching, especially on the left. However, by and large, the two leaders still enjoy, so this is Luigi Di Maio, the leader of the Five Star Movement, and especially Matteo Salvini, the leader of the Lega, still enjoy quite a lot of support. Their rhetoric, which is, you know, quite inflammatory against Brussels, the European Union, the financial markets, and the establishment, the old political elites, is still really convincing quite a number of voters. Now, of course, we'll need to see how that continues to be if they were to move into government. They will soon be forced to choose between breaking their pledges, their very expensive pledges. We're talking about, you know, very generous income support schemes or very generous income tax cuts, actually both of them combined. So either they break these pledges and then disappoint their electorate, or they go into a big confrontation with the EU, which will spook markets and certainly make interest rates on Italian debt go up. So it's a very tough choice for them, and I suspect that their honeymoon will not last for very long.
Just finally, Frederick, with the rise of Macron, there are lots of people who seem to think that we had seen the end of, or at least the demise of, populism in Europe. Do you think that was a misguided position?
Well, obviously, it was a misguided position. The election in March in France very clearly showed that there was a very strong movement behind both the Five Star Movement and Lega Nord, and that this was going to be a very disruptive election. So, obviously, Italian voters was seeking in order to disrupt status quo in Italy. That's also what we saw in the Austrian election not that long ago, with strong showing by the Freedom Party, the populist party there, and of course with the center-right party that for quite some time under its new leader Sebastian Kurz have been taking its core message very close to the populist Freedom Party. My point, however, is perhaps that it wasn't just a premature thought thinking that Macron had killed populism in Europe. I think it was a misguided thought that Macron himself represented the opposition to populism. I think you can, at least in some ways, define Macron himself as a populist, starting his new sort of his own political organization, breaking the power duopoly of the socialist and the center-right in France, the fact that he also wants to upset the status quo.
Thank you, Ferdinando, and thank you, Frederick.
What are you drinking this weekend? Start a cellar plan with Berry Brothers and Rudd, and soon you could be uncorking something out of the ordinary. To start your cellar collection, visit bbr.com/cellarplan.
And next, as Israel celebrates its 70th anniversary, Palestinians have been protesting along the Gaza border. In reaction, Israel has clamped down with force, but its use of live ammunition has meant that over 50 protesters have been killed. In this week's issue, Peter Oborne asks why the parliamentary group CFI, the Conservative Friends of Israel, has not criticised the Israeli state's actions. Peter joins us now, together with Stephen Crabb, CFI's parliamentary chairman. Peter, in your piece, you mentioned that CFI counts an estimated 80% of Tory MPs among its members. Why is it so popular?
Lord, you've got the chairman here. He'll tell you why it's so popular.
I think there are a lot of members of the Conservative Party who value democracy, value liberal democracy, values of freedom of speech, and all of those things are manifest in the modern state of Israel. And I think it's a natural thing for many Conservatives to feel a natural empathy and support for the state of Israel. We're not here to be cheerleaders of any particular set of Israeli politicians. We believe in defending the state of Israel. Don't forget, for so much of its history, it's faced attacks from many quarters, from neighbouring countries that have been hostile to it, from a continued campaign of terrorism in recent years as well. So there are many of us who stand on the side of Israel. Doesn't mean that we defend every act of the Israeli government, and we're certainly ready to...
Have you ever, ever criticised anything Netanyahu has done?
Well, we certainly ask the hard questions.
No,
of
I asked your director twice now in the last 2 weeks. Have you ever criticised anything the most right-wing leader Israel has ever had, Netanyahu, who is not an ordinary leader, and he couldn't come up with a single example of Conservative Friends of Israel doing that?
Well, it's not for CFI, the Friends of Israel, to take corporate positions on every aspect of current Israeli government
policy. You're always
policy.
Promoting positive stories.
What I can tell you is that we had Netanyahu's representative in the UK, his ambassador Mark Regev, in Parliament this afternoon at a session organised by Conservative Friends of Israel, asking some incredibly difficult and challenging questions to the ambassador about the way the Israeli army, the Israeli government, has conducted itself in recent days with the events on the Gaza border. And it's that kind of engagement that we're not afraid of having. Being a friend of Israel, a staunch friend of Israel, means that you're not there to be a cheerleader for everything, but it means that you've got that good relationship where you can ask the difficult questions.
Because I mean, when you say you're a great friend of Israel, of course it raises what sort of, which Israel are you a friend of? Are you a friend of the Israel which has shot dead with live rounds, 60 or so Palestinians this week and 100 or more in the last few weeks, at the same time as wounding with more than 2,000. Well, the Israelis themselves have had no fatal injuries at all, and apparently just one minor injury. Now, are you a friend of that, Israel?
Nobody supports and condones loss of life. It has been appalling.
Why don't you condemn it?
Because if you look at what's actually been going on the border this week, we've had a sustained and very highly orchestrated campaign by Hamas to breach the border using its fighters who've been armed in many cases. I mean, the leader of Hamas this afternoon confirmed that 50 of the 52 Palestinians who were tragically killed on Monday, 50 of them were members and supporters of Hamas, an organisation that's recognised internationally as a terrorist organisation. What other nation on earth would stand back and allow terrorist fighters to try to cross its border and
You're
bring
calling
chaos
the people,
and death?
The 2,000 people who've been shot, are you? This is a very interesting statement, and I hope you fact-checked it properly. So you're saying the 60 people who've been shot, including a number of children, plus the two other shot dead, and the other 2,000, the Faroese fighters, I haven't found any evidence that not one of them has had arms on them.
Peter, I'm just following the words of...
Repeating what Israel says.
I'm repeating the words of the leader of Hamas this afternoon.
He didn't say any of those things, an afternoon,
who confirmed that 50 of the 52 who were tragically killed, as I said, no one celebrates loss of life, were supporters or activists within Hamas, a terrorist organisation.
It's hell-bent
on the destruction of Israel and the harm of Israeli citizens. And, you know, let's not be hypocritical here. When Khalid Massoud, a year ago, breached the security cordon in the Palace of Westminster, armed with a knife, and attacked a police officer, he was met with lethal fire. That was one terrorist, armed with one knife, and he was met with lethal fire. What other nation on earth would not defend its citizens and protect its border, faced with the kind of scenes that we saw on Monday?
Well, the problem I think you need to explain is, you're saying that these are Hamas agitators. We need to see proper evidence for that. And in the meantime, you're supporting, but not one of them has had arms on them. So you're saying the killing of 60 unarmed protesters is perfectly okay. In Britain, by the way, you're British, by the way, we, in a dreadful event, Bloody Sunday, shot dead 13 Irish. It led to a massive investigation, a Savile inquiry. Do you think, this is 60 unarmed people killed. Should we have a Savile inquiry? Do we need an independent, massive investigation, completely independent, into what happened?
Well, I'll come back on the point about inquiry in a moment, but you say vehemently that these people were unarmed. We know that 8 of them were actually armed, and they were killed in an exchange of fire with Israeli forces.
Israel is the same.
So, well, we can have a discussion about this, but if your position, Peter, is just not to believe anything at all that comes from...
I'm sceptical. I didn't say nobody was armed. You said they were all armed terrorists at one point.
I didn't.
You were resigning from that.
No.
Anyway, we don't know the facts. The very great majority of them are certainly unarmed. There is no, unless you're suddenly, the Israelis are now claiming that was one exchange of fire. This remains to be seen. Hamas is making claims. It's actually also trying to piggyback on this. It is, you know, 2 million people in what David Cameron called a prison camp. You probably agree with your former leader about that, wouldn't you?
It's a humanitarian disaster zone, Gaza, and I've been to the region several times. I've talked to Palestinians, and the conditions that they live in are appalling. And it's very easy for the critics of Israel to always put the blame onto Israel, Israel being the author of every ill facing Palestinians.
No,
but in terms of what's gone on in Gaza, Hamas, the terrorist organisation which controls the Gaza territory, share a very serious and heavy responsibility, not just for the loss of life in recent days, but for the appalling humanitarian conditions there, where they divert aid into industrial levels of investment in terrorist activity, where they prioritise the vicious war against Israel over looking after the humanitarian needs of their own citizens. That's what they're guilty of, Peter.
Let's remind you a key fact. More than 2,000 people have been injured, including more than, I think, 1,000 through live gunfire. Approximately 60 have been killed last week, 100 in the last few weeks. Not a single Israeli has been killed and one has been slightly wounded. Now, that is so disproportionate. I'm surprised that you as a British MP don't want to ask more questions about that.
Well, Stephen, do you think it's hard for Tory MPs to criticise Israel, given that 80% of them are members of CFI?
Well, that isn't true. We don't have members as such. Individual MPs do not join Conservative Friends of Israel as an organisation. So I don't know where that...
What estimation would you say is more correct?
I'm quite happy to agree that around 80% of Conservative MPs are very strong supporters of Israel and therefore would attend CFI events and be happy to be labelled as friends and supporters of CFI, but we don't have an individual membership as such.
Can I ask you another question? I mean, I've never found any criticism of Netanyahu. On the other hand, the other day, and I find lots of praise for what Israel does. The other day, just a few weeks ago, a couple of months, the culture secretary, Israel's equivalent of Hancock, posted a social media post of herself at a football match where the fans were chanting something, "We'll burn your villages," to Arabs. "Burn your village, we're going to burn your village." Now, she posted it. That was an approbation of ethnic cleansing. Why didn't the CFI condemn that? Why doesn't it condemn that kind of racist behaviour?
I didn't see that tweet, and I'm not sure what you're referring to. I'm not saying you're wrong, but
I have examples of that sort of thing.
But what I can tell you, Peter,
There's racist behaviour by Israeli ministers. Why don't you condemn it?
But what I can tell you is that in Israel itself, if any Israeli politician posted something as racist and vile as what you describe, they would be met with a barrage of vehement criticism from Israelis themselves, because that is one of the hallmarks of Israeli democracy.
Yeah, I completely agree. Haaretz is brilliant. And civil society.
Let me ask you a question. What do you think would happen to a Gazan citizen if they went onto social media attacking the official line of Hamas? They wouldn't last very long, would they, Peter?
And that
is the hallmark of a terrorist oppressive regime. That's the difference of what we're talking about. We are supporting a liberal democracy in a very, very difficult neighbourhood of the world.
What worries me is this. If you were a friend of Israel, surely you should be a candid friend. When Israel commits what looked like war crimes over the last few weeks, CFI, as its friend, should say, look, hang on, you shouldn't do this. When Israeli ministers make racist remarks encouraging ethnic cleansing, surely CFI, as a friend of Israel, should really challenge that. Instead of which, we have a situation where you have never once criticised or censured Netanyahu for anything.
But good friends are candid friends.
You're right about that. That's the problem.
And good friends are candid and critical. And as I said, this very afternoon, 30 or 40 MPs and Conservative peers were meeting with the ambassador to put to him difficult, challenging questions about what we've seen on our TV screens. Now, what we haven't seen in the last two days...
Behind closed doors, but we need you to public...
Well, where are the leaders of Hamas putting...
I saw you in Parliament earlier this week, another Tory MP, clearly backed by the Conservative Friends of Israel, because you promoted what they said on social media, was going on putting out the official line that Hamas is responsible for the horror of the last few weeks.
Peter, can I ask you, do you think Labour's response to Israel's actions has been better?
I certainly think that Jeremy Corbyn has recognised that the Palestinians constantly are under occupation, something which Conservative Friends of Israel doesn't condemn the settlement building programme, which has done such huge damage to the peace process. And it doesn't recognise that the occupation is very dark. I wish you would.
I've led delegations of Conservative MPs to Israel. I've taken them into the West Bank. We've met with Palestinians, ordinary Palestinians, Palestinian politicians as well. I've led delegations where Conservative MPs have challenged Israeli politicians and diplomats on the settlement building programme. So it is something...
Yeah, I haven't seen your public statements.
It is something that we do.
Look, when I make a suggestion to you? When you next go to lead one of these, 119 Tories have been there in the last two years.
And rightly so. It's a good thing to learn about the
meeting. Why don't you introduce them to the Bet-Salem, Breaking the Silence, Israeli civil society organisations, which tell the truth about the occupation? Why don't you do that?
So,
will you do that? Because they'd love to meet you.
When I take delegations to Israel and the West Bank, we meet with a whole variety of different organisations and commentators and journalists, and we get a diversity of views, and we come back probably with more questions than
what about Brett Salem and Breaking the Silence? Do you know who they are?
I do know exactly the organisations you refer to. The line they propagate is a line that's very anti-Israel,
pro-Israel. It's just anti-Likud because they're both exposing the injustice and the atrocities committed in the occupation. Why don't you want your Tory MPs, when they go to Israel, to meet Breaking the Silence and Beth Salem to hear the other side?
Just finally, in Peter's piece, Stephen, he says that the CFI is essentially a London outpost for Netanyahu's Likud party. Do you think that's fair?
That's just absolute nonsense, and forgive me for being unkind about Peter, who sat right next to me, but it's just not the case at all. Conservative Friends of Israel have been around a long time. We're not here to be supporters or cheerleaders of any set of Israeli politicians. Politicians come and go. What we are interested in is defending the state of Israel in the face of persistent long-term attacks from its enemies on our shores in the United Kingdom, but also recognising that Israel is in a very difficult and challenging region where historically they've been surrounded by their sworn enemies. But one thing that Peter won't talk about is the fact that in the last year or so, Israel's had far more diplomatic engagement with its Arab neighbours than ever before. There is something very quiet, and exciting going on in terms of realignment in the Middle East, and that is a very positive thing. The bit that is missing is a peace process in Palestine, statehood for the Palestinians. That's something that I support. And it's just such a tragedy that Palestinians get let down time and time again by awful, appalling leaders like we see in Hamas in Gaza.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you, Stephen. And lastly, why do powerful men like to be spanked? In the last few weeks, several successful city men have got into trouble after their niche desire came to light. But writer George McCoy, who runs a website reviewing adult services, argues in this week's issue that it's not just an English vice. In fact, the industry is thriving all across Britain. There are popular sex dungeons in Glasgow and London and everywhere in between. George joins me now, along with Kaz B, also known as Mistress Kaz, a dominatrix from Reading who writes a column for the Daily Sport. So George, why do you think successful men like to be spanked?
I think for a short while they like the idea of regressing to their childhood where they didn't have to worry about how to run the business, and being spanked was part of their growing up. And that's the only explanation I can come up with, because personally I can't say that it's something that greatly personally turns me on, but it's an interesting phenomenon all the same.
And I suppose the vice anglais is what it was sort of known as, but you seem to think it's across Britain. Why do you think it is so popular in Britain?
Well, you had discipline in schools everywhere from here up into Scotland. You had the tours. The tours is there to be found in the dungeons in Edinburgh and Glasgow. So it simply reflects what went on in childhood with Cain this side of the down here and the tours up there.
Kaz, in your work as a mistress, do you find that spanking is a popular attraction?
Yes, it is. I find that I have gentlemen visit me from all ages, from 18 up to about 70. And it's not just British men coming to me. I've had German slaves, I've had Asian slaves, I've had all kinds of men coming to me for spankings. But the one thing a lot of them have in common are that they are in powerful positions in life.
Right, and so it's sort of a kind of humiliation. Is that what they like about it, the humiliation?
Yes, yeah, some of them. It's not always about humiliation with all of them, but the majority, I would say, are just looking to escape from the daily life, and they want to, you know, experience things on the submissive end of the spectrum rather than being in charge.
George, in your piece, you talk about these dungeons, which you can find all around the UK. Can you tell us a bit more about them?
Well, the dominatrixes will say they've got a dungeon. In some cases, it's just a converted room in their house, but there are extreme cases, though. The recession has seen off quite a lot of them because they're just so expensive to maintain. The most magnificent one I ever came across was in Dewsbury, of all places, where a converted vicarage with a church next door, which was still operating, strange to say, as a church, had been turned over into one enormous dungeon with different rooms with different facilities in them, and it was an enormous place. Mistress Helena with a double L was the lady running it. But I think, frankly, along came the recession, and the overheads of the place just meant that it just wasn't no longer economic. Similarly, there was only probably the next most impressive one I came across, and again one that failed, I think, because of it's just too big and too expensive to run, was an establishment called Victorian Dover. Halfway up the cliff going up to Dover Castle, there is a magnificent road cut into the side of the hill, and there was a house in there. It was a remarkable location and a magnificent premises, but again, long term, not economic.
Oh, what a shame. Those sound amazing.
Well, if we get another boat boom, some places like that will open again somewhere, I'm sure. And some sizable ones still operate, but they come and go. There was a very nice one practically opposite the Venezuelan embassy in the not far from Tottenham Court Road, and that one has unfortunately folded. But that was very busy, and one that one could hire, and various ladies would come along and use it from time to time. Probably the biggest one existing is still in a former bus depot in Birmingham. But that doubles as a place where they also make dungeon equipment, so it's all together under one roof. That was enormous.
Kaz, at your establishment, do you have a dungeon?
I don't, no. I tend to work from a domestic setting. I find it's flipped on its head now. Where it used to be the case where many slaves would want to be in a dungeon setting, I find that a lot of the newcomers to Femdom find that kind of setting a little bit intimidating, so they'd quite like to be in a domestic setting. Having said that, occasionally I do get a request for a dungeon. So there's one that I personally use down the road. Yeah, it's called the Fetish Studio, and it's absolutely amazing because it's really well equipped, and it's a lovely couple that run it as well. They've got absolutely everything there, from restraints, and you can even hang somebody upside down.
Yes, I'm aware of the Fetish Studio. Backs onto Prospect Park.
Yes, it's very good.
George, you mentioned the economy. Do you think Brexit is going to be good for the spanking industry?
Well, it all depends if Brexit works. I'm sceptical, but certainly most of the people I've met in this country who work in the adult industry are only too happy that Brexit's about to take part, but that's mainly because they feel they'll be able to rid themselves of all the competition they get from the many ladies who come over here from Eastern Europe. But the funny thing is, there's just as many who come from places that have ease of access because of these reciprocal arrangements. Lots of ladies working over here have come here from Brazil. Whether they should or not is another matter, but they won't go with Brexit.
And Kaz, can I ask you, has feminism had an effect on spanking?
No, I think there's a lot more, and there's various factors at play here. I still think, you know, the fact that 50 Shades come about a couple of years back, no other books and the movies, it swayed a lot of people, and they've wanted to dip their toe into fetish and try things like femdom. Also, there's a massive rise of femdom material on the internet as well. And I think once people are kind of subjected to this, maybe that's not the right word, you know, when they have these influences, they want to try it. And it kind of opens up that window for them where they know it's available, so they want to have a go themselves.
Can I ask you both for your advice to someone who's sort of listening to this and perhaps hasn't been spanked before but is quite interested in it, what advice you would give to them?
I think it really depends ultimately if they're going to be experimenting with a partner first of all, or if they're going to a pro-dom, because the rules for those two things are very different. If it's a gentleman or even female looking to go to a dom, then it's very different than being spanked by a partner. So I'd suggest they do their research first, find out a little bit about who they're going to see, make sure they've got good feedback and they know what they're doing. Because when someone's being spanked, and I'm sure George can tell you a lot more about this, there's certain areas that you need to avoid. So you can't, make a lot of impact in areas such as over the kidneys, because that could actually damage somebody. So my advice would be to check it out, read up about it, and always use a safe word.
And George, what would your advice be?
Well, on my website, there's plenty of free information indicating how many good, bad or indifferent reviews on all the various review sites there are, and there's loads of them around, for ladies who can offer not just corrective services, but other services as well of a forbidden nature all over the country. Just have a look at mccoysguide.com.
Thank you both. That's all for this week. If you enjoyed this podcast, do subscribe, rate and review us on the iTunes Store. We'd love to hear from you. And if you'd like to read all the pieces discussed in the podcast, do pick up this week's issue. There's also a tribute to Tom Wolfe, Wilbur Smith's diary, and much, much more. And we've got a special offer for podcast listeners. Simply go to spectator.co.uk/pod offer to pick up 12 issues of The Spectator for only £12, as well as a limited edition moleskin notebook. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.